Hallo en welkom bij de podcast. Ik ben Annemarijke Pot, Tweede Kamerlid voor D66. En in de Tweede Kamer houd ik me onder meer bezig met asiel en migratie. En daarover gaat ook deze podcast. Juist omdat er over asiel en migratie zoveel discussie is, in de Tweede Kamer en daarbuiten, is een podcast een ideaal medium om eens echt een gesprek te voeren met mensen die veel met het onderwerp bezig zijn. En zo krijg ik, en hopelijk jij ook, meer inzichten in hoe het echt zit. En mijn gast van vandaag en weer in de Tweede Kamer, dus het kan zijn dat je af en toe de kamerbel hoort, ze spreekt wel Nederlands, hebben we net geconstateerd. Maar we doen dit gesprek liever in het Engels. Dus, en dat is voor het eerst. Maar mocht je het gesprek willen nalezen in het Nederlands, dan kan dat. In de show notes, dat is het stukje tekst bij de aflevering in je podcast app, vind je een linkje naar die tekst. So with me here today is Maria Shaidrova. And it's so good to have you in this podcast. We've met before.
Yes, we did.
And Maria, you're a PhD candidate, Migration Studies in Tilburg University. Mm-hmm. And you're also Ukrainian. And since the start of the war in Ukraine, you've been diligently working on research related to Ukrainian refugees in the Netherlands. So we'll be going into that in more detail in a little bit. But perhaps first, a little bit about you. Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. So, you'll have already told my name. My name is Maria Shaidrova, and I'm a fourth year PhD researcher here at the University of Tilburg. But at the same time, I'm also chairing research and policy organization called Opora since recently.
You do that with other Ukrainians, right?
Not only. This is with other Ukrainians. Some of them are Ukrainian, some are international people, but mostly these are academics. Academics, then consultants, business consultants, and tech experts. So we are kind of a collective of people. We try to find solutions, but also hear the voices of people. And our motto is to be a bridge between decision makers and people, because of course we are part of the Ukrainian, but we are also have a heart for other migrants. So it's not just about Ukrainians.
Okay. And maybe good for listeners to know, because you did not come to the Netherlands as a refugee.
No. So, I actually came to the Netherlands 7.5 years ago to study migration.
Yeah.
So, of course, I studied at the UvA, at the University of Amsterdam, Sociology of Migration. It was my master's. And afterwards, I worked at the University of Tilburg as a policy researcher. So I was leading a big project on prostitution and different ways to regulate prostitution in 4 countries. So this is what I've been doing 2 years. And afterwards, I started my own PhD on basically risky migration patterns in Mediterranean. And I focused on Nigerian migrants in particular.
Oh, wow. So that's what you did?
Up until now.
Up until now. Because maybe just so people understand, what part of Ukraine are you from?
I'm from Irpin.
Okay. So, well, a lot of people heard about Irpin. So maybe that might be a difficult question, but how are your friends and family? Are they here? Are they back there still?
My male friends are back there, most of them.
Yeah.
My female friends are, almost all of them are in Europe. I was very lucky that my sister could leave as well with her husband, who is a Belarusian, so he could cross the borders.
Oh, wow.
With 2 children. Our house did survive, so now it's a shelter for people who actually don't have a house.
Okay.
So there is a family living there with 4 children, our family house, basically.
Mm-hmm.
I have visited Irpin recently. It was 3 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So it was a difficult experience also to not just to read about it and see the pictures, but also experience it.
Yeah, being in the middle of it.
Yeah. And also seeing the results of war, because I was not the one who was fleeing. So for me, it was a bit different. It had a different, I would say, taste and different, I experienced it differently, I guess.
Yeah.
But it was as sad.
Yeah, because that was my question indeed. Like, for me, it's so unbelievable what it's like. I mean, a lot of people know what it's like to study and work abroad, but then all of a sudden you wake up and you see your country being bombarded and seeing all your friends and family in the middle of that. What was that like?
It's difficult to explain how I feel. I think that's the most difficult. But I think what added to it is also that I'm a migration scholar who works on risky migration. So the first day I had this realization that, well, this is just happening in my country. And actually, the last 8 years of my life, I was studying people who were fleeing. So how does it feel to actually be a professional in this field, but at the same time, having your own family fleeing and also helping them to evacuate and helping your friends.
You had
and
a much more personal experience with it all of a sudden.
Yeah. And I think that kind of changed also the way I saw it and mm-hmm. also the way I expected things to be done, the way I look at the research and
In what and the sense solutions. Can you explain that?
In what sense? I think that one thing is to do research about someone, and I always felt uncomfortable, I think, fully to do research with black migrants.
Yeah.
But another thing is to actually help people who are connected to you, but at the same time being an expert. So this is not, it's about finding these borders, but also knowing exactly what they need. And I think that's the idea of like, maybe this is the time of my life that I can actually do something useful. That's also was my first reaction. And this is exactly how we started Opora and all the activities that we were doing.
Putting all of your knowledge and experience to the best possible use.
Yeah. Because I knew exactly what is going to happen. I think for me that was like, okay, I can predict. So I already knew that temporary directive most likely would be accepted. So we mm-hmm. translated it even before it was voted for in the EU.
Okay. I think I have to explain that for the people who are listening, because the temporary directive, can you?
Yeah, I can explain it. So I think that everybody is a bit confused why even in Dutch you use a different word for Ukrainian refugees, right? So we use the word displaced people. So I think that's partly from there. So people who were forcefully displaced or they had to leave their countries altogether, they also needed to be approached using different instruments because asylum status is very individual. So you need to have an individual reason of why you're fleeing.
Yeah, that's the case for other asylum seekers that come to the Netherlands. Yeah.
So and here you had to find the group solution because there was no individual time or individual even capacity.
Yeah, we knew that many people were coming our way.
Exactly. Yeah. So in this way, the Netherlands was a bit of like small Lebanon. So where people were actually just coming. So just fleeing, especially in the first months. So this is exactly where the idea of temporary directive came. And it was based on a situation that happened in with the Balkan War, where there was again the mass displacement and countries had to do something, but there was no directive. So directive came a bit later.
Yeah.
So this was an instrument, I would say the only instrument that you could use to actually host people. But the way you implement this instrument, that was pretty much dependent on the country and on the EU itself. So this is what I couldn't predict. So I could predict that the document would be used.
Yeah, but the way it was implemented,
no.
That was something else altogether.
For me, that again was like a possibility to show that if it is new, we can also approach it in a new way.
Yeah.
And then maybe we can also help all other migrants because it can help us to kind of write the letter from scratch or write something from scratch.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think this is a bit, it's interesting that these thoughts came to me while I was in this state, but I guess it was also my therapy.
Yeah. Sort of a way to cope with what was going on. Now, you already mentioned you started with research. It was into migration, but very different topics. And now you came to researching, basically the situation of people fleeing from your own country. So did that change your work greatly? Did that...
Well, I think it changed application of my work because as academics, we are not really good in policymaking and we are not really thinking about implementations. Mm-hmm. And moreover, we often don't know how to speak with policymakers or how to bring our point through because we are used to write big books or complicated articles. We use the concepts that are not really understandable. And this is something I was working from the beginning in my PhD. My dream was to actually make a bridge between the two.
Yeah.
Because I think that there are a lot of ideas that are very important and can be applicable and very easy to implement. But we just don't know how to communicate them. And I think that part, finally, I found a way that to actually communicate about it, to use my knowledge, but also provide very practical solutions of how can you manage it, actually, practically.
Yeah.
And this is what I was missing in my academic work. So in the way it pushed me and it changed the way I think.
Mm-hmm.
So now my research is not just about explaining things.
Yeah.
It's actually about pointing things out but also providing solutions for it.
Very nice. Well, it's very interesting, actually, because we have a lot of debates also here in Parliament about the use of empirical data and the use of scientific research for the work that we do, and that we often feel like, especially in the field of maybe asylum and migration, maybe, you know, our decisions aren't always based on that. So that's an interesting thing. And obviously, because, yeah, that's what I said, we've met before, because you are providing us also as parliamentarians with a lot of information about what's going on about the Ukrainian community in the Netherlands. So it's very helpful for me. And I think, you know, some very nice things came out of that already. So, well, we'll go into that more into more detail. But can you maybe describe how it works? How do you get your information from the people that you work with?
Yeah, I think then it's important to, of course, go back to how we started. Okay, first of all, I'm Ukrainian, so of course I know the culture very well. Ethnically, I'm very mixed, so of course I can also relate, but also put myself a bit further from the culture. I think that helps to also keep the cold head sometimes to mm-hmm. whenever I think of solutions. So that first thing that helps, I already have an access. And compared to my research with Nigerian migrants, when it took me a long time to get an access and be accepted in the community, it took me half a year minimum. Here it was not the case. So you were already there and people did trust you. Yeah. So that was the first thing that helped. And of course, in the beginning of the crisis, research was not my priority. So my priority was crisis management. So we needed to provide people with information. So this was our first decision as a group, that back then we were just volunteers and we didn't have an organization. We were just thinking what to do. So we thought, okay, we first need to provide people with information about everything that is going on and about their rights, because they're very stressed. Yeah. And that's how we launched our small website with information. Afterwards, we decided that, okay, it's important to also provide people information when they're calling or writing us. So we did a help desk. But this also helped us to understand what is going on the ground.
Yeah, because people are asking certain questions, so you know what is exactly worrying them. Yeah,
exactly. So, yeah. But we, as researchers and tech experts and statisticians, so we decided not to just have a website or helpline or anything else. Or we were also hanging out in all kinds of forums and we had our own families in houses. So that all helped. But we also thought, okay, we can use it as data points in the beginning. So we can actually check how many requests for every different question was there. Mm-hmm. So, and how many times people ask about this. So how does it change? So what kind of pages on the website are being used the most or visited the most in which time and which in which week, and how it's the dynamic changes. Mm-hmm. And that's how we started in April, seeing that from the questions of like, where can I just find a place to sleep and what will happen with my status? We started looking at where can I find work?
Yeah.
I think I need psychological help or like something else is going on. So then we started thinking, okay, this. So now we already have to start thinking about long-term or strategical things, not just reacting in crisis,
yeah.
but also thinking about the strategy.
Yeah. What would be next?
What would be next? Yeah. And kind of react to it and also plan it. So, and that was already in April. And that's exactly where we started also notifying different organizations and asking them, okay, you're only reacting to crisis, but it has been 2 months.
Yeah.
So now you have to think long-term. And of course, we know the context of our country and the relationship with Russia. We understand them. We could predict that it will not be a 3 months conflict. So
yeah.
that also helped us to prepare.
Yeah.
And starting from April, we changed the direction where we are going. And we started thinking, okay, maybe we need to really measure needs. And that's how we and use more scientific methods, meaning surveys and observations. And
how do you get surveys to people who are everywhere in the Netherlands?
Well, I think it's about the communication. So what we also did in the beginning, so we have realized that this crisis, I would say that was a crisis in the beginning in March, although I'm quite critical about the crisis in general.
Mm-hmm.
People, I think that what was different from all other streams of migrants is that they were relocated.
Yeah.
Usually. And here people were coming and there was no borders and there was no control. So people were coming all over the country and you in the beginning had no grip on where they are,
no.
Who is hosting them, are they safe, what do they need? And people were not having any clothes or bank accounts or money. And of course, a lot of very nice and kind Dutch people were also picking up people from the borders. But then they didn't know what to do with them.
Yeah,
so exactly. I think that, and there was also no procedure, and the Netherlands was the most expensive country. So what we were thinking, okay, we need to find the way to reach the regions and reach the Ukrainian diaspora, community, volunteers, anyone in the regions, and try to understand the situation in the regions.
Yeah.
And right afterwards, of course, there was implemented Veiligheidsregio structure. We had the similar idea. So we thought, okay, we have to make this network of different volunteers across all Veiligheidsregios. Mm-hmm. And then we will know exactly what is going on in every single and what are the problems. And I think this is how we started with gathering data. So it's not just a lot of people are saying, oh, we just listen to a community. But it's good to listen to a community, but it's also good to listen to those who really know.
Yeah.
So sometimes you can also imagine that if you are living somewhere abroad, let's say in Australia, it doesn't mean you know everything about what do you need or what migrants need who are coming. So we gathered the most active people in these regions. And that's how we always had basically grip on what is going on. And apart from different, so I would phrase it differently. Before there was a central organ that was coordinating the situation with migration, meaning COA. In this situation, these were municipalities.
Yeah, it's very decentralized.
Exactly, and they didn't have any guidelines. Some of them have never experienced any migration flows because, again, it was not controlled. So it was not somebody who was. Now it's more controlled. So people are being sent to certain municipality or not. Yeah.
But especially in the beginning, it was very confusing.
It was very confusing. So we have realized that too. So we thought, okay, in some municipalities, people are not even paid leefgeld. So in some municipalities, they did an amazing, like, innovative approach of how to manage it. So I cannot say decentralization was a bad thing, but guidelines had to be there.
Yeah.
So I think that it's more about guiding municipalities, helping them to actually manage it. And that might, if we do it correctly, and I think if we continue doing it, then they'll be more open to host more people.
Yeah.
But this was the rationale and how we gathered data.
Yeah.
Now, in the last research, we did it very properly. So before, it was more situational analysis. So it means that you measure every 2 months what is going on. So it's not a proper research with the design.
Mm-hmm.
So the latest research we did was on education, and we had up to 600 respondents.
Oh, wow.
So that one we did by developing a form, and we spread it in different kind of channels through our network of volunteers, but also through all kinds of Telegram channels and in regions, in every
region. Telegram is like a medium that is used quite a lot by Ukrainians.
Yeah, and also Facebook. So we used all kinds of media, and of course it was about improving the education, and parents were quite happy to answer it. And they were also very trusting. So because they knew it was in Ukrainian, they knew that we were actually caring for them, and that, I think, pushed them to answer. And also answer qualitatively.
Yeah.
So we had 400 qualitative answers about how you can improve or what you can not improve.
Well, but maybe tell us a little bit more about that. Like so you've asked people about what's going well in education, what's not going so well. What can you tell us about that?
First of all, we were quite surprised that up to 50% of parents don't know anything about Dutch educational system.
Oh,
so
wow.
I think that was quite interesting. And
something we have to do something about, probably.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's the first thing. The second thing is that, of course, in the first months of war, when children just had to relocate very quickly, it made sense to provide some alternatives, to have, for example, Ukrainian-based schools or something like this. But with time, we have realized, looking at the data, that might not be the best solution long term. And why is that? Is that we correlated the psychological state of children in different forms of classes that they were.
Yeah.
And these were mixed classes. So they were Dutch elementary classes, ISK classes with only Ukrainians, or ISK with mixed, with other nationalities.
Because maybe to explain a little bit, Ukrainian children are in very different types of education. So some of them are indeed the only Ukrainian kid in a school that's all Dutch. And other Ukrainian kids are in a group of mostly Ukrainian kids. And you say ISK, which is the Internationale Schakelklas, which is the place where
children go when they come from abroad and they have to first learn the language because before they can sort of take part in Dutch education. So there's very different circumstances that they're in.
Yeah, I think that in the beginning, there was no real policy on it. So no. It was just about providing children with a place to study. And of course, they all had their studies in Ukraine as well. In July, they adopted a new law on temporary education, which kind of obliges all the schools to actually implement the program of Schakelklas. So yeah. That's they try to implement now. But again, as in case of everything, it's the responsibility of the municipality to do so, right? Mm-hmm. To organize the education process for a child. And some of them have capacity and some not. And that's why in some ISK classes, there are only Ukrainian children too. Or now yeah. they call them I think tijdelijk onderwijs. So it's something like ISK, but for Ukrainians.
Yeah.
But the idea is very similar in the end. So what we did, we measured how that correlated with their psychological health. And then in the end, we found basically that children in the Dutch classes and mixed classes were happier than those who were in Ukraine.
Oh, wow.
Or their parents reported so there was a correlation between their psychological state and also, and satisfaction. So the psychological state and satisfaction and the form of the education they were in.
Okay.
And that was also very interesting for us because we were like, okay, so we thought maybe it's good for children to have other Ukrainians, but
yeah.
And but we tried
that
to
might be different than we expected.
Exactly. Yeah. But then we tried, because it's correlation, so it's not causation. We cannot conclude anything serious from it. But we followed it up with some qualitative interviews of parents. And we had the focus group with parents, but also with teachers. And then also we checked what is going on in Ukraine itself. And of course, when there is a trauma or when children went, not all of them are traumatized, but they went through something traumatic. They had to change the place and there are a lot of things going on and their father is also not with them.
Yeah.
So what happened is that basically for the children, the first reaction in the school of trauma is aggression. So of course, when you're with other Ukrainian children, you also get more aggressive.
Yeah.
And the bullying is there. And especially if the teacher is a Dutch person, it's very difficult to understand that this is going on.
Yeah, what's going on. Yeah.
And this is exactly what was kind of making children more aggressive towards each other. There was a lot of using, a lot of bad words that they were using towards each other and everything. And a lot of parents reported that on the Ukrainian-only classes. So for us, it was like, okay, then how can we manage it? That was one thing. Of course, we can call for mixed classes, but we cannot do it because there are just not enough teachers at this moment. So we just...
So you also need methods to make the
children socialize, no matter what.
Yeah, and to make the ISK model work for them as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
So even then, but then maybe it is good to also involve not just Ukrainian teachers, because if you involve Ukrainian teachers, that means you have Ukrainian class either, or you provide them with some education so that they become Dutch teachers in the end.
Yeah. Yeah, you need something for the longer term as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But have a more community managers or people who can involve parents as well.
Interesting.
Because I think in the end, that's one thing is about the mixed classes. But another thing that we found is that parents want to be involved, but they cannot be because they don't understand anything.
Yeah.
And involving parents is always increases the, basically the satisfaction of the children, but also it helps children to grow. And this is not a Ukrainian problem. So if you look at the research done in the Netherlands before, a lot of migrant parents are not so involved in their education of their children. And one idea is, okay, because they think it's not so important, but that's not true because they have a language barrier. So they simply cannot follow.
Yeah.
And that's why maybe their children don't end up in a higher education just because the parents couldn't help them in the right time to get there as the Dutch parent would.
So does that mean that some of the things that you are finding out now and some of the things that you are suggesting basically might also be useful for a larger group of people with a migrant background in the Netherlands?
Definitely. I think that's the whole idea of what we are doing. So we find Ukraine as like a case study.
Yeah.
Because there is nothing really done well on it yet.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of efforts and everything, but it's not yet institutionalized as for example, migration procedure or asylum procedure is.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that in this way, yeah, we do look at it as a case that we can use, and things we learn from it, we can for sure apply in other situations. Yeah. And another part of it is that if you count all asylum seekers, it's like a small, it's a small group. Like yeah. Relatively, if you yeah. even compare it to expats and so
it
on.
It is, yeah, very much
but
so.
But if you look at the Ukrainians, there are 30,000 children. So I think that the fact that they're a big group, all these problems, they come up. So not because of them, but because they have already yeah. been there. It's just that yeah. they were not addressed.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned that, because I think we spoke before also about the fact that a lot of people, both in parliament and I think in Dutch society, are now addressing the point that it is difficult to see how the government is treating Ukrainian refugees so differently from asylum seekers. And people say that that's unfair, or that's, you know, they have, yeah, and justly so, I think, difficult feelings about that. How do you see that?
Yeah, I also had a lot of questions and talks about it with yeah. colleagues and with other activists, because I mean, before I was only working with Black migrants, right? Mm-hmm. So I know very well the discourse, and I was always on the point of, yeah, we have to listen to people and we have to give people more agency. And
yeah.
so that was always my position.
Yeah.
When it happened with Ukrainians, it didn't change. I think that, but what people don't understand is that how did it happen that Ukrainians got a bit more rights? It was not that, I think it was in a way a lot of different factors. So first, the fact there were no borders.
Yeah.
So that there were just no way to control it. I don't know what would happen if the borders were there.
Yeah.
Because the Polish people just opened the borders. So you yeah. could have crossed the border no matter what.
Yeah.
You had no control over where people are, what they do. So in a way, that also created a precedent where you had to actually yeah. find solutions like temporary directive to at least make people legal in the country,
yeah.
which they haven't yet finished giving stickers. Mm-hmm. Some people are still undocumented.
Yeah.
But I think it was in a way a force. As for the work, it's also, this is a good example where we can argue that this is possible.
Yeah.
And actually we need the working force.
So just like you were mentioning before about the research you're doing in education.
Exactly.
We can actually learn from what's going on with the Ukrainians and then make it better for everyone.
Exactly. And that's how I see it. So, and I don't know, I know that, for example, now, and also finally, if you have the neighbor that is sort of similar culturally to you
mm-hmm.
and that is not located very far away, and then the neighbor's house is burning.
Yeah.
You're getting more scared because the fire can come to you.
Yeah.
So I think that's not just about racism per se, although I think it is also there.
Yeah.
But it's also about this fear of like, it's close to me, so yeah. I have to do yeah. something about it.
Yeah.
But from, as I said before, is that from feeling, from a lot of emotions of love, the hate is also not far, right? So
yeah.
love and hate, they come together.
Yeah.
And then well after a very extreme emotional reaction, usually it is accompanied by all other things that other migrants will experience. So I think that the fact that Ukrainian situation is delayed, but it doesn't mean that will not end up there.
Yeah.
So if you look at how, for example, Polish migrants are being treated in the Netherlands and all these stories with the Meldpunkt for Polish people and so
yeah.
on, you can see that it might come there. So
yeah.
we might, and then the way... depending on how we treat it, or how many people can work, on how well they are integrated and how well Dutch people can get into communication with them,
yeah.
but also pretty much predict of how what kind of life will they have. And
yeah.
when they have a very big group, and it is 77,000, it's a lot. So that
yeah.
means it will stand out.
Yeah.
And then we will see what happens. So I think that I'm not... making big conclusions now, but I also want people to see the other part of it.
Yeah,
so of course, and I agree that it's better. And I think we can copy to all other migrants. That's what I would fight for, because I think it's just, if we have such a shortage of force in the Netherlands and we just can't find them.
In the workforce, you mean?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And you have adult men who can work and don't work, and then we spend our money, tax money on... actually giving them food and shelter, but
yeah.
meanwhile they can actually work. I think that it's very profitable for the country.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, because what we see now, I think the latest numbers, at least that I have, maybe you have better numbers than I've, but over 68% of Ukrainian people are now working in Netherlands, which is huge.
Yeah, considering that 30,000 are just children.
Yeah.
So you can say that even higher.
Yeah, I don't think they're counted in the number, but still. Yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah. It is a high number.
Yeah.
I think what I have a problem with it is that the fact that there is a huge uncertainty about temporary directive, and this is another part of it. So, yes, now they're better and they can work, but temporary directive in the Netherlands is finishing on the 4th of March. So,
and people don't know what will happen after that. Yeah.
Not only people, but employers too.
Yeah, true.
So that's one thing. So many of those people who in the 68%, they actually work with temporary contracts, or they worked in agriculture or the hospitality industry that is not as active in winter.
Yeah.
So we don't know what will happen. That's one thing. Another thing is that not all people got documented, of course. I mean, now the next 20,000 will get it in the second half of October, hopefully. But still, people were not properly documented. And the only thing they related to was the exception from the law, right? From Minister of Social Affairs, which takes, whenever you prolong it, which takes at least 6 weeks to actually be processed. And that's, again, uncertainty not only for people, but also for employers. And I think that this is my kind of a worry now, is that we have to have a procedure of how we prolong it.
Yeah,
it shouldn't be that, of course, if everything goes wrong or good, like, we don't know, but we now know it's just 6 months away.
Yeah.
So it's nice to have a kind of clear plan of what we are going to do if we need to prolong it.
Yeah.
And the sticker for now is valid only until the 4th of March, and it's not possible to extend, so you need to do it all over again, the whole procedure. And it took IND, I think, 7 months to do that one.
Yeah.
So
So you can't possibly ask that of people to do that again and again.
But you have to arrange. So for me, the problem is not the implementation, but the logistics. So it's more about how you think of solutions that just makes logistic work better.
Yeah.
And then... But then we have to prepare for it 6 months in advance. And
exactly. And not a week. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. We already talked a little bit about your own experiences sort of going back to Ukraine. Now, obviously, people coming from Ukraine have sometimes experienced horrible things. And I imagine that also has an effect on people's mental well-being. Can you say something about that and about what needs to happen to support people?
Yeah, I think that together with my organization in the beginning, when we just were volunteers again, now we have a bit different focus. But back then we had psychological support,
mm-hmm.
and we managed to handle like 200 cases of very difficult cases. And we had a database of up to 70 volunteer psychologists who were actually helping people on the whenever there was a request.
Yeah.
So that was until May. But then we realized that psychologists themselves, they are burning out because they can't work legally. They do it all for free, like all of us. But at that moment, we were all just tired. And I think that at that moment, I thought, okay, that cannot continue because these people are here.
Here too, you need a more permanent solution.
Yes, yeah. And they're here. We already have people who actually help them. That's good. But this is a paid job.
Yeah.
And we also have a shortage.
Yeah, it's not a volunteer thing.
No, I mean,
no.
And also we have a shortage of these people in the Netherlands. So it's kind of, in a way, opportunity to fill in the gap.
Yeah.
I cannot say that all mental health specialists in Ukraine are perfect or not all Dutch mental health specialists are perfect. But yeah, you have to find the system of how you actually integrate them in the Dutch mental care system. So of course, one thing is to prevent, but it's difficult to prevent when something already happened. So it's not that you can prevent by educating people about PTSD, but then you also have to find a way to bring it across to people because Ukrainians are not so open to receive psychological help. So it's not in the culture. So what we were thinking, and together with GGZ, we set up a task force on how actually with is possible for Dutch institution to hire a Ukrainian person, both for preventive care, but also for curative care.
Yeah.
Because we were afraid that if you have a preventive care and you come across some cases that are more severe, you need to refer them.
Yeah.
And sometimes work with translator did work, sometimes not. And I think with children, it almost never worked.
Yeah.
So because children are they're generally not easy to approach, right? Especially teenagers or children after 10. But also when there is a translator who doesn't understand the culture at all, mm-hmm. and the child, and there is a translator who actually tries to bring, tries to help the child by translating Dutch person, I think also doesn't work. And we started developing a system where we can basically hire psychologists via those who have a big number. And then
a big number is like the number that all of the Dutch psychologists and mental health professionals need.
Yes.
Yeah.
But they can hire supervisees. So they want somebody who they supervise. And that's the way you can do that. But then you have to also make sure that all the hazards or all the family doctors actually know about it. So they can refer to them. So one thing is to develop system and even to hire, because some organizations did hire people. So they did. But another thing is to make sure that people are coming to the specialists, that the doctors know about it. So what we do in our organization, what we plan to do, is to actually help with communication, with developing operational also strategies of how to, as what I explained, it's not just us. So it's a lot of organizations who thought about it. But what we try to do is to bring kind of to find the way to coordinate it so that it works.
Yeah.
So that we can. So we did the research on how many specialists are there in the whole country. So what are their backgrounds? And you can see even like statistically, we made a map of like where the most of them are located. And then we also tried to persuade GGD's to actually work with them.
Yeah.
It's still a long way. And I think another part of it is also to make sure that basically people do go to the psychologist and not just trying to find online consultation or anything. This is a communication. And for that, you need, again, a community manager, somebody who people trust can actually
refer them and be a bridge. The professional.
Exactly.
And
that's probably a bit how we call ourselves. It's like we are a bridge between decision-making persons and people on all levels, on political or on governmental level, but also in these situations as well. So
well, we talked about it here in Parliament as well, of course.
Yes.
And just before the summer break, we got a motion accepted or a proposal accepted to hopefully support you in making this go a little bit smoother. Because I think it's very important, and especially also making sure that people get help soon. Because, you know, the longer we wait, the more difficult it might get for people. So,
Yeah, and I think, again, if you think about the numbers, even if we know that statistically only 10% of 77,000 will have any PTSD symptoms, this is a lot.
Definitely.
I think, and now generally, and again, it points out to a Dutch problem with mental health, right?
It does.
So it's not necessarily about Ukrainians.
No.
This is only the way to actually provide help to Ukrainians by Ukrainians, which makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
But it also points out in the fact that we need to think about it more on a country scale of like, okay, we don't have enough professionals and Ukrainians might not stay in line for 3 months because there are other Ukrainians. Otherwise, they would stay in line. And the Dutch person with suicide might also stay in line.
Yeah.
Of course, I'm now exaggerating because if you have a suicidal thought, there will be a reaction right away. But the person who needs help, let's phrase it like that. And I think that, again, like having the big group that has the problems, actually, it's not creating new problems. It just mirrors the problems we already have and probably have to solve.
Yeah. There's a lot of broader scope work to be done, definitely. Yeah. Now, obviously, there's many Dutch people who have been involved in hosting or working with Ukrainians as a volunteer, either to teach people the language or helping them find their way. Is there something, you know, based on all of your experience over the last couple of months that you can give to these people as suggestions or advice on?
I think a lot recently about judgments, how we make judgments about what is going on, about what people can do what people cannot do, what is safe, what is not safe, what people should do with their lives. But at the moment when you went through war experience and you lost everything, it takes at least a couple months to even start functioning again. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of expectations from Ukrainian people about how they have to behave and everything. But think about yourself, what would happen to you if you are in a new country and you don't know? And you can be quite annoying for people who are around you. Mm-hmm. And I think that just bear with it and talk about it and don't make too many judgments. I think that that's maybe my main advice, because what I hear recently is people say, yeah, but it's already nice and safe in Kiev, so you can just go back. And I was there in Kiev and I was very scared whenever there was alarm going on. It was like three times a day. And I was like, no, I understand, because some people just want to go home because they are really, really attached to their house. In Ukraine, we are super attached to the house, because it's not like in the Netherlands, people buy it with their own money. So it's super, it's not that you take...
Hypotheek.
Exactly, in the bank. So people have very kind of strong connection with the house and a place and the people. And even if it's destroyed, they still want to go home. But it doesn't mean it's safe.
No.
Especially people who are being hosted and the families, I think it's the most difficult, because as any person, you get tired of each other, right? So,
yeah.
But not let that kind of guide your decisions, but still try to be as human as possible, understanding the situation. And of course, in this way, I would say the same to Ukrainian people. You went through a lot, and sometimes it can affect the way you react or overreact on things.
Yeah.
But that's also because of that. So I think that educating people how to speak with each other, how to build a relationship and how to actually go through this difficult situation they are in and maybe bring something good for the Netherlands, that is exactly what I would advise.
Yeah. So maybe finally, Maria, you mentioned already many things that still need attention. I think we have a lot of work to do also here in Parliament. But is there maybe one sort of small thing or bigger thing, one priority that you would like to bring attention to in for us as parliamentarians?
I would say two things. One I already mentioned, but I'll mention it again, find the procedure.
Yeah.
Because otherwise we get into another crisis.
Yeah. So a procedure, you mean for the longer term, making sure that people...
Exactly, for a temporary directive.
Yeah.
So not... Yeah. Because it will really affect not just people's well-being, but their ability to work, but also ability to go to school, but also municipalities, the readiness of municipalities to actually do long-term strategy. So yeah. It's better to...
It's a way for everyone to sort of invest in the future, because you're not going to invest in your future, not in your own future, but also not in the future of people in your community if you don't know what happens to them in the long term.
Exactly. Yeah. So this is the first one. And the second one, I think that I already mentioned the guidelines for municipalities. I think this is still should be done, because we see a lot of cases when people are kicked out from the location by managers and by people who are not necessarily connected. They're connected or outsourced by municipalities. Mm-hmm. It's not that municipalities really wanted that to happen, but it happens, and it happens all over the country.
Yeah.
So I see sort of a pattern here, and I think it could be pretty much solved by creating guidelines of how people can outsource. That's one thing. And creating a reporting system for Ukrainians themselves so that they can report these cases, because there is no. So some people report to National Ombudsman.
Yeah.
And he helped to solve several cases like this. But they don't have a direct access. They don't know how to do it. So what they do, they usually find the volunteers or they find friends who can fill in and who would think about calling the Ombudsman. But it's nice to actually give them an instrument where they can report, but also tell them about their rights.
Yeah.
Because I think that these stories when people are kicked out and they don't know what to do, especially also from private houses, also from locations when people did something wrong, there was a conflict in location, that the guard even has a power to actually kick the person out.
That so should I think be the case, of course. No.
So this is something I would like to bring attention to.
Well, it's a good point, because obviously we've been working in this super decentralized system, which has many advantages, like you mentioned before. But we also need something to be able to sort of oversee, is it going well everywhere? And I think we're beyond the stage now that we're just sort of doing things haphazardly. We now need something more structural in place.
Exactly.
Yeah. Maria, good luck
Thank
on
you.
Your important work, and keep informing us, because it really helps us. And obviously, I think I can say this on behalf of many people who will be listening, I wish for a very peaceful future for Ukraine. Veel dank, weer in het Nederlands, aan iedereen die heeft geluisterd. En wil je me iets laten weten over deze podcast? Of heb je een vraag over asiel en migratie die eigenlijk aan bod zou moeten komen in een volgende aflevering van de podcast? Neem dan contact op via het mailadres in de show notes. En wil je de volgende aflevering niet missen? Abonneer je dan in je favoriete podcast app. En dan zie je vanzelf wanneer er een nieuwe is. Graag tot de volgende keer.